Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Je vous propose de commencer notre session de ce matin. On continue notre tour du monde et des protagonistes de la GPA. Nous avons trois présentations ce matin. Petit rappel aux personnes qui présentent les communications, comme on a la traduction simultanée, s'il vous plaît, parlez lentement et distinctement. Merci pour les traducteurs. Alors, je donne la parole à Sheila Saravanan qui nous présente donc une communication, Liberté pour qui, justice reproductive et contrat de GPA en Inde.
Good morning. Everybody, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak here. Today I'm going to talk about surrogacy my experience of surrogacy arrangements in India from the perspective of feminist perspective and a reproductive justice perspective. So just a brief introduction of my presentation outline. I'll be talking about, first of all, I'll situate India in the global scape, and then I have just a small review of my study area. Then I go from personal, what are the personal choices that are there with these surrogate mothers, and what are the local biologies which Aditi Bharadwaj has talked about as, you know, the local situation in which these women made these. So I would like to situate India in the global scape. I would like to bring forth that 22%, according to official figures of the total population in India, are declared poor. And there are other estimates that say that 56% of the population is poor. This is based on other means, you know, that lack of the means to meet their essential needs. So it has many other factors in it. And the corruption, that only half of the total public money spent on basic services actually reach the beneficiaries, and much of it is lost to inefficiency or corruption. And there are some social inequalities that I would like to bring forth, is that 50% of both girls and boys drop out before completing school, completing their 10th grade. And this has implications on their life course. So early dropout means early marriage. So 47% of the girls marry before the legal age of 18. There's early childbirth. 16% of the age group 15 to 19 begin childbearing. Maternal health is high, maternal mortality is high, and half of the women in the reproductive age group 15 to 49 have anemia. And this is a very important point, because many of my surrogate mothers that I had met were anemic, and they were then pumped with medicines to increase their, to show that they are fit, and they were given all kinds of medicines to show that their blood count was higher. And another very relevant point is 20% of the maternal deaths in India is due to anemia. And it's also important to say that the reproductive, one-third of the women in the reproductive age group are underweight. And these are all national figures from NFHS, that is National Family Health Survey in India. The other point is the primary health care services that is there for people in India. There are inequalities. So according to the government estimates, 18% of the primary health care centers are without a hospital, 38% without laboratory technicians, and 16% are without a pharmacist. And the consequence of the shortage is that many people in the rural areas and the poor in urban areas receive inappropriate or no health care. There are also glaring inequalities in the health care access. So you, on your right side, you can see the primary health care center where poor people are going, and there were many mothers were there in this line coming for their regular antenatal care. And on the left-hand side, you see a very posh clinic, IVF clinic in Delhi, and you can see the difference. And it's I'll just like to relate this to surrogacy. Is there was a, when I was waiting in the waiting room in Anand, there was this very poor woman who had come all the way from Madhya Pradesh. So she had come, taken an early morning train and come and landed up there. because she had heard that this doctor is a very good IVF doctor. So she was sitting there for hours and hours and hours in the waiting room along with me, waiting for the doctor to respond. And eventually she got really angry, and then she had to fight with the receptionist to get a 5 minutes appointment. And the doctor saw her and said, "Oh, I can't do anything for you. But if you are interested, you can, you know, donate your eggs. We are having a egg bank." So she got really irritated and came out, and she said that, "What is she? She's crazy." So, but on the other hand, when we were waiting for all these 4 hours, there was this big minivan, AC minivan that came. It brought all the intended parents from the so-called hotels. They came and stood there. These intended parents were taken straight to the AC waiting rooms. They had separate toilets there, and all their work was done within half an hour. So that is the difference between how these, there are different toilets for people like me and the surrogate mothers, and all of us were in one category, but then the intended parents had different toilets, different facilities, different waiting rooms. So I just give a brief about my study area. I went to two clinics, one clinic in Anand, which had surrogate homes, and the second is Ahmedabad, which had no surrogate homes. So both are in Gujarat state, also known for very highly for its progressive, for its business community and so on. So I had interviews with 13 surrogate mothers, 6 of their spouses, 5 intended parents, and they were all from abroad. There was one non-resident Indian in that, and 5 doctors. Now, the second round of methodology that I had is I followed these 5 surrogate mothers very in depth, right into their entire process after they had also done. And some of them I am even in touch with right now. And with this kind of participant observation, I could do only with 2 intended parents, and both were from Canada. And sorry, there's one more. There was one from Germany, but he was very secretive case, so I can't really talk much about him. So let me start with their local level, right from the individual level. What are the personal choices these women have? So this is one case where this woman worked as a housemaid. She earned about 10,000 rupees per month, and it's about 140 euros. And some people would say that, okay, they're not really poor, 10,000 rupees, they can survive. They're not living on the roads or something. But one has to put this in context, that anybody falling sick, any dowry, any marriage, any death, anything in the family can put them straight to the bottom of the poverty line or income line. So she lived in this, and they realized this, and that is the fear that makes them have this, go into these kind of activities. So she lives in this one-room rented house without a toilet and a bathroom, and I spent a few nights in her house. She wants to buy a similar house of her own to save rent and also to save money for her son's education. Her husband has left his job, at least for that 1 year when she was in the surrogate home. He had to leave his job because he had to look after the son. And she had to repeat her surrogacy because she didn't earn enough to buy a house. Now, house means, I don't mean the kind of European houses that we have. It is exactly that four-walled house that she buys. Whatever she's living in, she buys a house exactly like that. So what is the personal choices that she makes is that they know that they are in this kind of situation. So they get into a trap of, the sale of body parts. So it can be in form of drug trials. It can be in form of gamete donations. And eggs are get paid a lot more than sperms, So it's the women who get burdened with this, getting into this, more into the body sale. And surrogacy is the most remunerative among all this. So how these women get into this is either a surrogate agent combs through a low-income community. So she actually goes from house to house and sees, okay, which woman, which household is in a very dire condition, let us go once. And then if she's not convinced, go again. And then if she's not convinced, go again 3 times. So finally convince her into surrogacy. But if she are already into drug trials and egg donation, then they are already in that process. So they join surrogacy. Now, this one, this is only blur photo I had her for her, so I put here. She's a mother from Canada, and she's a professional herself. I don't want to tell her profession, otherwise you can find her on the internet. Her husband owns a computer firm in Canada. She's desperate for a child. She's undergone several rounds of IVF, and she said she was on the verge of suicide. And she has adopted one child from Vietnam. You can see that child in the middle. And she came to India to do her to have more children. So she had a second round of children from India. And specifically, why she chose India was because it's cheaper than Canada. Thank you. And she had already adopted a child. Oh, sorry, it's too much of hassle in Canada, she said. And there are lesser rights for surrogate mothers in India. So why she selected this particular clinic was because surrogate mothers are monitored throughout the process. She was really happy with that. And we don't have to pay money any upfront. You know, they're paid in smaller installments, and that actually helps her to keep the baby. And she had a lot of trust on the doctor. So this intended mother is posing with the children because she didn't have the email contact of the intended mother, this surrogate mother. So the intended mother, did not share the address with the surrogate mother, so she shared it with me, and she sent me the photographs when I was about to go to the surrogate mother's house. So she said, you go and show these photographs to her. And I would like to say that one thing about this surrogate mother was that she's a really powerful woman. And she would tell off anybody in her locality. If they ask her anything about what she's doing or about a surrogacy or about her whereabouts, she says it's none of anybody's business. It's my business, my life, and all that. But the actual realities that she faces is in the surrogate home. So it is compulsory that she stays in the surrogate home. And she's detained in this house for 10 months. She's restricted from movements and meeting from family. I have a case later. I don't know whether I'll be able to show it. But she's not allowed to meet her family members, even if someone dies in the house. So they are overfed. They are expected to care for the baby. And for me, it is an inability to participate in public and private life and meet all her non-reproductive aspirations. And this is not only the case of India. This similar kind of surrogate homes have been found in other parts of the country. So, and there is a violation of good medical practices. Up to 5 embryos are transferred illegally into the surrogate mother's womb. In utero, selective abortions are done if more than 2 result in pregnancy. And surrogate mothers are really unhappy about this because they know that it also causes miscarriage, just the in utero selective abortions. And for all more than 1 pregnancies, surrogate mother's cervix is stitched. So it's called cervical cerclage. The mouth of their cervix is stitched so that she doesn't have a baby normally. So it is an emergency situation. So anybody who gets a labor pain has to be rushed straight to the operation theater. And it's 100% cesarean sections that take place in this clinic. And all this obviously without her consent, because she has already given her body off to the clinic. And there's a commodification of children also in this process, I feel, because many children are born preterm. I already know of several children who have died. The surrogate mothers have got to know that their babies have died. The payment of the babies are many times on the basis of the weight of the child. There's no additional payment for miscarriage, and we all know how much they get very less paid during the pregnancy. Disabled children are sometimes left in orphanages, and in one particular case, a surrogate mother told me that she had a girl child without a hand, and the next day a similar child was found under the bridge, and she had a very, very high intuition that it is her child that was there. So, and we all know children all over the world, how they are left, you know, stranded in India because of citizenship. And there's no long-term studies on this at all of what is happening to the children. So this is another case. I don't know whether I have the time to get into this, but it's just that another case where Turkish parents arrived late. And in that time, it's not only surrogate mother and her husband, even I was looking after the baby. And suddenly these parents arrived from abroad and said, thank you very much, bye, took the baby and walked off. So all of us were shocked what's going on here. And we had even, the mother had even named that child. So, and they just came next day, gave the money to the clinic and walked off. It was just a payment that they had. So this slide is about, I followed the woman, the surrogate mother, into her house after the post-relinquishment and what was happening in her life. Her mother had died and she couldn't go because she had to tell lies because she had to go to the surrogate home. And she said, why did I, the shock in which all of us were there, the way the Turkish parents came and took the children and went off. And she says, why did I have to spend 1 year of my life away from my children, my family, couldn't come back for my mother's death, for this, you know. So I could have, might as well stayed in my own house with my children. So she didn't repeat surrogacy, but she is into the trap of egg donation. I think I'll skip some of these slides, but these are all cases of motivation of the surrogate mothers and how I found a German a twin suddenly in the slums of India, and how, incidentally, it is the same mother who was writing emails to me, and she had said the food has got finished, and so I've gone to Germany to buy more food for my children. So I brought all the food from Germany, and when it finished, I travel again. So she was in this travel between India and Germany, and it was illegal, so she was not there. She was not allowed to do it, and she was on a tourist visa in and out of India. And this is another case of a woman who was a surrogate mother from the clinic which had no surrogate home in Ahmedabad. But I'll come back to my last three slides, which is on, I'm taking a feminist human rights approach in this. I've already talked about the inequalities, the global inequalities. And I'll just have two slides, one on liberty and one on justice, reproductive justice. And there are two, as you can see, there are two binary views in this, that one is on liberal, in general, they're feminists and liberal feminists themselves. And on the other hand, you have human rights and other kinds of feminists who say that this is a choice between poverty or surrogacy, cannot be a choice. And more attention should be paid to provide basic needs for these women. And there is a violation of personal dignity, integrity, and economic exploitation in this manner cannot be defined as constitutional rights. And of course, what they want to do from it also is completely contrasting. One wants to harmonize and one wants to prohibit. For me, I look at the liberty issue, is surrogacy as a solution to infertility? I say that those who are facing infertility have to go through a lot of pain. So they have to go through social stigma, they have to go through psychological problems, physical stress of infertility treatment, and they're also going through violation of bodily integrity, because I personally have several friends who are into this process of IVF. And one, it's like a tunnel. Once you get into, you have to see the end. And I have heard many of my friends saying that, you know, I have to prove that I tried my best. You know, so one cycle didn't work, second cycle didn't work, then the next, and then you go into, even more violation of your own body and then psychological problems. So this process, when you get into a point of surrogacy, you're putting through another woman exactly through the same set of problems that you have, that I have gone through, or my friends have gone through. So social stigma, psychological challenges, violation of her bodily integrity, and also her, the surrogate mother's health in case of, the global inequalities and the case of India. You're also putting the surrogate mother's health, freedom, liberty, and even her life at stake. And that, for me, this kind of market based on demand and supply of cheap wombs cannot be a solution for infertility at this stage. And the other concern for me is, approach for me is on from the reproductive justice framework, that there are people who contend that surrogacy in India does not create further inequalities. But it is very important for us to see that these kind of practices in countries like India are already embedded in deep structural inequalities, and without looking at that, we are missing out on one part of the jigsaw puzzle. I'm not saying that even if we have that, we have the entire jigsaw puzzle, because we still don't know. There are no long-term studies on the health and what is the health impact on these women, what is happening to the children. There's still a lot of, it's just very small jigsaw puzzle that we are trying to fit. But by not looking at the structural inequalities, we are not looking at that important part of it. So from a feminist Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice, along with the Sister Song Collective, this is a framework that they have developed, that reproductive justice should recognize the histories of reproductive oppression in all communities in the world and try to change the structural power inequalities. And by identifying and addressing multiple oppressions of race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, age, and immigration status. So a reproductive justice framework that aims to reduce these inequalities cannot use someone else's vulnerability as a solution for global infertility. So some of my concerns still in India is that it's completely banned, but then I have spoken to some of my surrogate mothers in India, and it's not really banned inside surrogacy, inside it's happening inside India, and for commercial purposes, there's nothing has gone black market, underground or anything, it's happening openly. So people are getting paid for it, inside the country it is happening. So there is still issues of power inequalities and reproductive justice unresolved, I guess. And thank you very much for your attention.
Donc la parole à Vania Savova de l'Université de Sofia en Bulgarie.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a little bit moved being here with you because that's my first speaking in front of so sensible and understanding audience, because all the times I've tried to speak on the topic so far, I have to explain what gestational surrogacy is and that it concerns only the altruistic form. And I'm speaking about not human testing. I'm explaining a kind of suitability, psychological suitability. Because in gestational surrogacy, psychological issues related to kinship, emotional bonds, attachment, and relations arise. So, in fact, that project was socially inspired because 5 years ago, Bulgaria tried to legalize surrogacy. And I was part of that process, working as an expert in the Bulgarian parliament, as a psychologist. Unfortunately, surrogacy was not legalized at the end, but that project, as a result from that work at that period of time, might be implemented in any society, regardless of cultural differences, with altruistic, not commercial form of surrogacy, of course. And being a counselor, I'm working with lots of families in Bulgaria going through gestational surrogacy, of course, abroad, in Greece, Russia. I have only some doing surrogacy in India. So that's my narrow field as a psychologist, surrogacy. I don't have conflict of interest. I'm speaking not about commercial surrogacy, and I'm obliged to say this. That model of assessment is based on attachment patterns, relevancy to the gestational role. Why did I choose attachment? Because all the years I've been reading and listening to scientists speaking about the surrogacy from medical and from biological, genetic, ethical, bioethical point of view. The main idea I got is that all of them are speaking about attachment. Is attachment possible to arise to happen in situation of missing genetic link. Psychology has very stable data on attachment. Attachment, just a simple clarification, if you don't mind, because it's a psychological study and I'm not going to explain all its methodology, the testing itself. I'm just trying to explain the main idea. Because all of us has, in general, three types of attachment: dismissing, which means that a person had some unresolved and avoidant patterns of behavior due to problems with their parents. Secure type of attachment, which is non-clinical, of course, the most reliable, which means that a person has secure ways of connecting with people. And the third one is unresolved, which means preoccupied, which means that a man or a woman has unresolved issues, even trauma, in their childhood. So my main idea, I'm saying it at the very beginning, is that an intended surrogate, an adult, a person with dismissing or avoidant type of attachment is a reliable, suitable, okay, applicable for a surrogate, because the fear of the society and all of us, of course, is that surrogate is possible to connect, to relate, to attach emotionally to the fetus, to the unborn child. You know, all the popular cases in States, Australia, Europe, some in Europe, had happened due to that emotional relationship. That's why I tried to test it. Is dismissing avoidant pattern of attachment a reliable testing measure? I have researched all the medical, legal, psychological, ethical background in the States, Europe, Bulgaria, of course, I'll say briefly only some words about Bulgarian attempt to legalize it. The current situation is that surrogacy is prohibited according to the family code, law health. Currently in the process of assisted reproduction, surrogacy of any type is not allowed. And 5 years ago, that's the definition Bulgarian parliament tried to give to surrogacy. You see, intended parents, surrogate, and that part with the sperm donation has been rejected. Only egg donation was accepted. The five amendments on bills, on five laws, passed first reading, and at the second, the text were left. So that work might be continued in some years, I hope. And the purpose of that legislation was to appoint the medical indication, of course, the origin of the child, not a parental order, not a legal process similar to adoption, but to point very clearly the genetic origin of the child, written in their birth certificate. It was going to be totally, thoroughly altruistic, like egg donations in Bulgaria, and of course risk prevention, my topic, what I'm speaking about. So that gave me very clear, stable argumentation and justification of that test. Because there was a requirement for the future intended surrogates to have one alive child before the procedures, like in many countries regulated surrogacy, that gave me the argument, because society has fears about that attachment. The data so far is not reliable at all, I mean psychological. only Professor van den Acker, of course, Golombok from Cambridge, and Professor van den Acker from Middlesex has researched perfectly the significance of the missing genetic link, that it is the most important thing which should be taken into consideration when talking about gestational surrogacy. Saying it briefly, when you don't have the genetic link, it's really very less possible to have attachment to the child. And because I have read all the theories from prenatal psychology, which speaks about that attachment communication with the fetus, I saw that none of them, the earlier psychoanalytics, the modern prenatal psychologists, none of them, I'm citing their names, none of them is speaking about attachment. All of them are speaking kind of bonds, conditions, connections, but not attachment. So we are not talking about two-dimensional affectional relation in gestational surrogacy. The answer might be, no, there is no attachment, but I have to taste it. That's why my model is strongly based, thank you, on Ellie Timmons' research, speaking about that shared commitment. I think that the attachment really is between the intended parents and the surrogate, not between the surrogate and the fetus. There is bond, but it's not attachment. And of course, all the time I'm relating my data to John Bowlby's theory of attachment. Why? Because he says attachment is biological. It's an instinct. It's not theory, not it's behavioral pattern. But with clear biological roots. That's why the important is attachment possible in gestational surrogacy, very important, because it's an instinct. To some people, it seems it's inevitable. But I think that's not the case with surrogacy. So my hypothesis, as I said, is that avoidant attachment is an appropriate criteria for a gestational surrogacy. Secure or safe autonomous attachment is likely, but we don't know. And the preoccupied is totally irrelevant. So that's why we first have to test the attachment patterns. I made it with adult attachment interview. And then to test that attachment pattern, to relate it to the nature of the gestational surrogacy. That's why we are using the attachment theories, the prenatal psychology data, and gestational surrogacy so far. And very important, the motivation, because adult attachment interview and attachment theory happens to be predictable for the motivation of the surrogates, which is totally altruistic, and for my responders too. I chose adult attachment interview because it's the only instrument which reveals us the transmission of the patterns, reveals the attachment to the own genetic child, and the responder's attachment in their childhood. Two figure of attachment. I said that there are three types in general. And these are the attachment scales. It's a methodological issue. Yeah, I tested the intended surrogates in three stages with the test, motivation interview investigation, and of course their life history, which is also very important, not only the test. And according to the attachment interview classification, the first thing I did, I analyzed the data, of course, with the content analysis, the discourse, and other specifically psychological instruments. And the result is that only one of my responders have a clear dismissing or avoidant pattern of attachment. The others are with mixed types of attachment. And at the end, I prove that avoidant attachment is an appropriate criteria. I'm sorry, I'm missing the methodological part, really. But that's not the point. The preoccupied is irrelevant, as I claim in my hypothesis, and we don't have reliable data. Why about the secure attachment? Why? Because in secure attachment, it's possible the life experience and the cognitive schemes to be very coherent and integrated, and that woman, the intended surrogate, to be so in, so lively experiencing the. On adult attachment interview, but also on a motivation survey. It should rely on national legislation and lots of popularization and education to the society. Because people are very dependent on the legislation. If something is legalized, they say it's okay. Till not legalized, they have some doubts, I think. And at that time, I was part of I Want a Baby Foundation work, and it really did a lot. I'm glad I was part of that. And I will always be if there's an opportunity. Sophia University supported that project. Most famous medical doctors in Bulgaria also. And I would like to thank to the patients with fertility problems. And responders, of course. Thank you very much. I hope that interruption is not due to my long speaking.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Présentation là sans le support. On va passer la parole à l'intervenante suivante, c'est Vasandi Jadhva de l'Université de Cambridge au Royaume-Uni et qui nous parle de l'expérience au Royaume-Uni.
Thank you very much. I did bring a printed version because I don't trust technology, but we've got it all up and running, which is good. Thank you very much to the organisers for inviting me to speak to you all here today. I'm going to be talking about a longitudinal study that we've been carrying out in the UK. The study I'm talking about is... is a follow-up study to an earlier investigation. But just to give you a background first about the practice of surrogacy in the United Kingdom... Surrogates can receive reasonable expenses, or the amount they receive has to be approved by a court of law. There are two types of surrogacy practiced in the UK. I know a lot of the talks at this conference have been talking about gestational surrogacy, but in the UK, traditional surrogacy is still widely practiced. So in gestational, a surrogate's egg is not used. In traditional surrogacy, the surrogate's egg is used, Also in the UK, in order to apply for the parental order application, which is the process by which legal parentage is transferred from the surrogate to the intending parents, that parental order application can only be carried out by couples. So heterosexual couples and same-sex couples are able to apply for a parental order. So the surrogate is actually the legal mother at birth, and the intending parents apply for a parental order when the baby is 6 weeks old. So in 2013-2014, there were 189 parental order applications in the UK. We do know that this is an underestimate of the number of surrogacies taking place, and that's because people going abroad may not apply for a parental order, particularly if their names are being put on the birth certificates. And also, single men cannot apply for a parental order. So those numbers will not be reflected in these. So we had specific research questions we wanted to ask in this study. Do surrogates experience psychological problems? And by that, I mean depression or what are their levels of self-esteem in the long term? What are their motivations for carrying out multiple surrogacy arrangements? So in the UK, we know some surrogates go on to carry out more than one surrogacy. I wanted to know their reasons for this. Do surrogates stay in contact with the intended parents and the surrogacy child? And does the psychological well-being and family relationships of the surrogate's children differ between traditional and gestational surrogates? And how do the children of surrogates feel about their mother's involvement in surrogacy? So the current study, like I mentioned, is a follow-up study to an earlier investigation, which we published in 2003. In that study, 34 surrogates were interviewed 1 year after the birth of the child. So 10 years later, we went back and asked these surrogates to take part in a new study. We managed to recruit 20 of those original surrogates into the second study. The main reason that we couldn't include more of those original surrogates is because we couldn't actually find them. So they'd moved address and we didn't know where they were. Only two of them had declined to participate in the follow-up. So in order to increase the sample size, we recruited 14 additional surrogates who had had a child around about the same time. We interviewed 11 of their partners and 36 children of the surrogates as well. And these 36 children came from 23 families. And they were aged from 12 to 25. We had a lower age limit, so they did have younger children, but they weren't included in this study because we wanted to ask very detailed questions about the surrogacy, and we weren't sure if younger children would be able to answer those questions. I think with hindsight, we probably could have lowered that limit, at least to the age of 10. And we did have some 10, 11-year-olds who really wanted to take part. But by then, our ethics approval had all gone through. So I won't go through everything on the slide. But just to explain, it's not a requirement that you have to have a child in order to be a surrogate. Most surrogacy organisations that practice in the UK will advise that you already have a child, but it's not actually a requirement as such. Most of the surrogates were married or cohabiting. Most of them had skilled, non-manual or professional managerial jobs. And the section at the bottom of the slide here explains the type of surrogacy that had been carried out. So 12 surrogates had carried out only traditional surrogacy. 14 had carried out only gestational surrogacy, and 8 had carried out both types of surrogacy. And actually, that last one was quite a surprise for us, because previous studies up until this point had shown that surrogates were either gestational surrogates or they were traditional surrogates. So we were actually quite surprised that we found this group of women who were doing both. But before I go on, just to say that I know terminology has come up quite a bit. So in the UK, we tend to call surrogates surrogates, although some women are happy with the term surrogate mothers. I will be referring to the child born through surrogacy as the surrogacy child, and that's not to be confused with the surrogate's children, so the surrogate's own children. So like I said, a lot of the surrogates had done more than one surrogacy arrangement. So between the 34 surrogates, there are actually 102 children born through surrogacy. Most of these were for heterosexual couples. 4 were for same-sex couples, and 2 were for one single man. The age of the surrogacy children ranged from 0 through to 18 years. So we were really interested in why they had carried out more than one surrogacy. The average number of surrogacies they were carrying out was 3, and the most that a surrogate carried out was 8. 31% had said that they wanted to help a family have a sibling for a child. So that was the main reason for doing an additional surrogacy. 23% had said they wanted to help a childless couple, which is the same motivation that's also given for a first surrogacy. 15% said they had a previous positive experience of surrogacy, so they wanted to repeat the experience. 7% enjoyed pregnancy, and again, that's a very similar motivation as to what they would give for a first surrogacy arrangement. Other reasons include having an unfulfilled expectation or aim from a previous surrogacy. So if they had a surrogacy that perhaps didn't meet their expectations, they wanted to have another one so they can kind of end on a positive surrogacy story, if you like. 2 mentioned payment as a motivation. 2 said they were requested by a surrogacy organisation. 2 had said they hadn't intended to do a further surrogacy, but had met a couple that they wished to help. And then there were other reasons given as well. So this is just a quote to kind of illustrate how a relationship between a surrogate and an intending parent might sort of develop. So this surrogate said, "I love the fact that although they'd had a really hard time, they'd never moaned about it. And all this, you know, they were really, really nice people. And we'd met at a few get-togethers and just chatted. And then I find myself offering to have their baby. If I wasn't too old now, I'd still be doing it. I absolutely would. The first time we met up with a view to having an arrangement together, we went to a restaurant. I thought, yeah, these are just really genuine people. It was lovely. And by the end of that meal, I'd offered to help them if they wanted to do it. Because again, my age was an issue. And we just moved ahead very quickly." And she then gets pregnant very quickly with these intended parents. And after the birth of the child, she says, "About 6 months later, I said, because they'd still got embryos, I said, you know, I'm more than happy to give this another go if you want to. And it was straight in and worked first time again." So it's these relationships that are being built with the intending parents. That means that for many women, they want to continue working with the intending parents. And so they're helping them have a subsequent a sibling for the child. So just to explain how surrogates met the intending parents. So in the UK, it is illegal to advertise for a surrogate. It's also illegal to say that you're willing to be a surrogate. 52 of the arrangements came about through a surrogacy organisation called Childlessness Overcome Through Surrogacy. In 21 cases, the couple was known from a previous surrogacy. 14 was from another surrogacy organisation in the UK called Surrogacy UK. 4 had met them through the internet. 3, the couple were family members. In 3 cases, the couple were friends. And other ways included being introduced by a family member or a colleague, meeting somebody at a fertility show. The Surrogacy Parenting Centre was in operation. It's no longer in operation in the UK. And one had met through Facebook. So we measured self-esteem using the Rosenberg Self-Esteem Scale, and we also measured depression using the Beck Depression Inventory. We looked at whether there were differences in the type of surrogacy that surrogates had carried out and their levels of self-esteem and depression, and we found no significant differences between these 3 groups. So we were also interested in whether surrogates stayed in contact with the intended parents. We have to remember these are all domestic surrogacy arrangements. So all the intending parents are living in the UK and all the surrogates are living in the UK. Well, actually, that's not quite true. There was a couple who were abroad, but you have to be British in order for a surrogate to help you in the UK. So across all 102 surrogacy arrangements, surrogates stayed in contact with 77% of the surrogacy children, 85% of the mothers, and 76% of the fathers. And if we look at the frequency of contact that they had, we see that most frequent contact is maintained with the intending mothers, with almost 50%, almost half, being in contact with them at least once a month. So we looked at whether or not they're in contact with the intending parents and the frequency of contact differed between the different types of surrogacy that was being carried out. What we found is that there is no difference in whether or not a surrogate is in contact with a family based on the type of surrogacy she's carried out. However, when you look at the frequency of contact, we do find differences. So as this table shows, surrogates who had carried out gestational surrogacy arrangements were in much more frequent contact with the intending mothers and intending fathers than surrogates who had carried out traditional surrogacy arrangements. But there's no difference in the frequency of contact with the child. So we, like I said, we interviewed the children of surrogates as well. And these are the surrogate's own children, not the surrogacy child that resulted from the surrogacy pregnancy. And we measured their self-esteem. We gave them the GHQ questionnaire, which measures psychiatric disorders. And also we assessed their perceptions of family relationships using a standardized tool. We found few differences, in fact, no differences between the three different types of surrogacy and children's levels of self-esteem, their scores on the GHQ measure. However, we did find a difference between traditional and gestational surrogates' children in terms of their relationships with their fathers, where children of gestational surrogates reported better relationships with their fathers compared to children of traditional surrogates. And the other number that's highlighted here indicates that there is a small difference. So it's not a statistically significant difference, but it's approaching that for differences on the way in which a child sees themselves, their role in the family, again showing slightly better perceptions of their role in the family for gestational surrogates compared to traditional surrogates. Now, when we looked at this a little bit further, what we realized is that the traditional surrogates were more likely to have experienced divorce or separation. So these children were actually living in divorced families. And that kind of then illustrates and explains why the father-child relationship is slightly worse for the traditional surrogates' children. So we asked the children of surrogates, how do you feel about your mother being a surrogate? And the vast majority felt very positive about their mum's involvement in surrogacy. So this child, she's not actually a child, she was 21 years of age, but her mother had been a surrogate. She said, I think it's great. I mean, I'm dead proud of her. Now, obviously, at the time, I probably didn't understand it as much, but now I've looked into it a lot more. I'm really proud of her. Like, I think it's amazing. I'd love to be able to do it one day myself. And five of them saw it as being either neutral or felt quite indifferent about it. So this child says, I don't have a problem with it. If mum wants to do it, that's her prerogative. So we didn't find anybody who felt negatively about it, but the vast majority were positive and some were actually not particularly concerned. We asked the children of surrogates what aspects of the surrogacy did they find difficult. I think about seven children reported difficulties. These numbers, some of them gave more than one difficulty, which is not really clear from this slide. But these are the sort of things that they were saying. So maintaining a relationship with the surrogacy child was difficult for them. Health complications for the surrogate. Receiving negative comments from others. The surrogate not being able to take the child out. The baby being handed over was upsetting for one person. And seeing the surrogate upset was also upsetting for one child of a surrogate. We asked them what aspects of surrogacy did they find rewarding. They said that the relationship with the child and the intending parents was a particularly rewarding aspect of the surrogacy. Feeling proud of their mum, helping another family, seeing their mum happy, travelling and meeting people, and surrogacy having a positive effect on their own family. And this last one actually was something that came out from the surrogates' interviews as well. It's often mentioned as a motivation for some surrogates that they actually gain a lot of pleasure and happiness from their own families, and so they can't understand what it must be like for people not to be able to have a family. So that is, we did find that these families did have particularly close relationships between the family members. So we asked, terminology, like I said, is a big thing in this field, as you know, and it creates, you're creating new relationships and new connections where there is no existing terminology for. So we asked the children of surrogates, how do they refer to the child born through surrogacy? What sort of terms do they use? And these are the things that they were saying. So some would say brother, sister, sorrow sister, half brother or half sister, a sort of a cousin. Some would just refer to them by name. One mentioned tummy sister. So these were the different terms. And then we looked at whether or not children who had a genetic connection to the surrogacy child, because their mum was a traditional surrogate and had used her egg, were using different terms to those where there is no genetic connection. And we find that's not the case. And what was actually happening was they were using terms that actually reflected the strength of the relationship they had with the surrogacy child, rather than whether or not there's an actual genetic connection between them and the surrogacy child. Thank you very much.